friends. We received a letter from one of our Canadian listeners in Saskatchewan, and it reads as follows. I have a little brother, and he says that all bishops are bald on top. And I told him you were not. He said it would be a miracle if you were not. So would you take off your little hat and show him that you are not bald? May I tell you, little man, that the difference is this. All of the other bishops had mothers who told them that they would all come out on top. I have more problems than they do. They don't have the problem of whether to part their hair in the middle. The subject of this telecast is how to think. First of all, how to think about statistics and figures and graphs. Secondly, how to think about new ideas. First of all, how to think about statistics. There are two kinds of reasoning, or two general ways of thinking. Now, here we're getting very deep, but it will only last for a second. You can turn off to another program while I explain this, then come back. It'll be over briefly. One way of reasoning is called deduction, and that is from the universal to the particular. For example, all men are mortal, John is a man, therefore John is mortal. And the other reasoning, from which there come graphs and statistics, is induction. Induction is from the particular to the general or the universal. Now, one of the reasons why we have to use this particular kind of reason is because we would never know certain conclusions unless we made an investigation. That's one of the reasons we have to have statistics. For example, suppose you wanted to answer such questions as these. Is marmalade stickier than jam? Well, you have to use induction and go around and stick your finger in marmalade and jam. Or this problem. Do babies with blue booties cry louder than babies with pink booties? Which do men prefer, night shirts or pajamas? That's the question you would have to investigate. You never could find it out by deduction. Now, these inductions can be complete when you investigate all of the cases and all of the samples, or they can be incomplete. There are very few that are actually complete. For example, a mother has four children, three of them are in the room. She says, where is Gwendolyn? As soon as she gets the answer, she has complete induction. She's made an investigation of the location of all of her children. Now, incomplete induction means that you cannot investigate all cases. So you take some samples and investigate a few. From these, you get statistics, you get graphs. I want to tell you about a graph. Picture that I have hanging in my office, and I have it hanging there in order that I will never take graphs and statistics too seriously. I want you to take a look at it. The title of it is The Fund for the Poor of the World. And the 12 months are at the top. And the line, the graph, is very, very low. In fact, the fund is low until you get to the month of June. And then in June, it skyrockets. And then comes down again very low the rest of the year. I am seated at a desk answering a telephone, and I'm saying to someone, looking at the graph. Let's see now. Last year I was away in June. That's when everything went up. Suppose now we wanted to make some statistical finding about how many youths in America under 21 years of age said their prayers. How could we do it? Well, one method, we might telephone them and say, are you saying your prayers? And then secondly, we might hide a camera in the bedroom and take a picture of them. And thirdly, we might also ask them to keep a diary and write down every time they said their prayers. Suppose now I gave you a statistic. Suppose I investigated the number that said their prayers, or I said that I did, and I gave you this answer. The 12.3% of the youths of America under 21 years of age say their prayers. Now, you'd be very much impressed with that, wouldn't you? Because there's that 3%, and you'd say, my, that must be scientific. That 12.3, that was one of the great advantages, incidentally, of the Ivory Soap advertisement. Ivory Soap, 99 and 44, 100% pure. And you would say to yourself, my goodness, if Ivory Soap admitted that there's 56 one-hundredths of 1% impurity, that must be good soap. It was the fraction that got you. All right, now suppose I said that, 12.3. Now I'm going to tell you how we might arrive at that conclusion. Suppose I investigated. Can I investigate all of the youths in America? Suppose I phoned 600 of them, from which I got 12.3. I'm going to give you some rules or statistics. And notice how they're going to be worked out. Whenever you hear a statistic, always ask these questions. One, how many possible cases are there? That is to say, how many cases could be tested? Two, how many were tested? Three, can you believe what they told you? That was the problem Kinzig had. Did everybody tell Kinzig the truth? Not on your life. You can't be sure if you call up the boys and say, did you say your prayers, that they said their prayers? And fourth, if it comes from an independent laboratory, who paid for the experiment? If cigarette X blows much better smoke rings than cigarette Y, who paid for that investigation? The independent laboratory isn't in business for their health, you know. Now, keeping this in mind, suppose we investigated 600. How many boys and girls are there in the United States under 21 years of age? 60,160,000. You think that's a pretty good test? How many are we getting? We're getting 6 out of every 601,600. Work that out in percentages. What percentage of the youth of the country are we testing? Now get this. I'm not finished yet. Of 1%. You see, I'm a rapid calculator. Did you ever hear about the rapid calculator? It was a man who was on a train. Somebody behind him said 648 cows as they passed by one field, 1,238 cows, 78 cows. And individual was curious. He said, how do you count them so fast with this train going this way? He said, I'm a rapid calculator. And he said, I count the legs, divide by four. All right, if I investigated 600 cases out of the 60 million, I've only sampled 0.000099% of the cases. How much is it worth? Nothing. Nothing from the point of view of reason. Remember, in 1936, there, the Literary Digest sampled 10 million people. And after sampling 10 million people as to how they would vote, they concluded that the electoral votes in November of that year would be 370 for Landon and 161 for Roosevelt. And they consulted 10 million. What do you suppose we're going to get if we consult 600 or 800? Did Landon become president? Anybody got an old Landon button just to remind us of these things? another sample. Some years ago, Johns Hopkins University admitted women to the university. The following year, I was reading in a work on statistics, figure was given out that 33 1/3% of the women who attended Johns Hopkins University married professors. That was marvelous opportunity for young women going to a university. They would have a choice of all of these learned men. All right, what are the laws of figures? One, how many cases were possible? Two, how many were investigated? So we asked, how many students were there at Johns Hopkins? Women, three. How many married a professor? One. So if you want to think clearly, always, always find out how many cases were possible before you believe a statistic. Now, here's one statistic that you can take from me that is absolutely reliable. And it's worth remembering. 50% of all of the married people in the United States are women. The other 50 are men. Now, another way to think is never completely follow a mood. See, there are styles in thinking just as there are styles in women's clothes. I once saw a man running like mad with a hat box in his hand. I said, what are you running for? He says, I'm trying to get the hat home before it gets out of style. Well, there are fashions in thinking, too. And the fashions in thinking are made by sciences. For example, we've had three styles. We had biology, was a very popular science at one time, and then physics, and then psychology. In 1859, when Darwin published his Origin of Species, not scientists now, but popularizers, lyricizers, romanticizers, those who felt that art and literature and everything else should dance to the tune piped for it by a science, made everything evolve. For example, Grant Allen wrote about the evolution of God, evolution of marriage by Westermarck, creative evolution by Bergson, which the whole cosmos was evolving. I used to attend lectures at the University of Paris. Bergson was their teaching, and he was very popular, you see, because he had romanticized this. It was the mood and fashion to talk of evolution in those days. And you had to go sit through a dull, stale, flat, unprofitable lecture on mathematics in order to save your seat for Bergson's lecture. And all of the fashionable dames of Paris and London were there. You'd find outside of the Collège de France, you'd find automobiles, Rolls-Royce, Chanard Walkers, Hispanis, Suiza, Reynolds, and all the fine machines. I remember one day coming out of the class of Bergson, some English lady spoke to me. She says, "Wasn't that a wonderful lecture?" I said, "What did he say?" And so she told me something that he didn't say, and I spoke to her in French. She didn't understand a word of French, but Bergson was wonderful. So it was the fashion. Then that fashion died. Then when Einstein developed his theory of relativity, then we got a whole group of lyricizers here who said that everything is relative, relative to space-time. And then we got relativity of morals, relativity of law. And then we got a new kind of literature in which we were constantly getting back to new beginnings. Remember Gertrude Stein, a rose is a rose, is a rose, is a rose, is a rose. And Professor Alfred North Whitehead of Harvard said that God is a creature whose matrix is space-time. It was just the popular thing to do, to talk about space-time. And then that ceased to be popular, and then we got into the domain of psychology. And when Freud, as a scientist, published his work in which he developed the importance of the subconsciousness, which was indeed a great scientific contribution, there immediately cropped up here those who made everything dance to the tune of psychology. Then you got juvenile delinquency explained away as an Oedipus complex. God was called a father complex. Then you got a new style of literature. Notice today the short stories don't end, they just stop. There are no characters in literature like there were in the Victorian era, characters with an ethical simplicity like Micawber or Uriah Heep. They're disconnected, like pearls in the string of which is broken. And one is interested only today in the psychology of everything. That's because it happens to be a mood. Now the point is this. One cannot take, and you think well, remember that you cannot take the methods and the conclusions of one science and apply them indiscriminately to another science. Each science has its own object, its own method, and it is entitled to that method. But you cannot take it, cannot take biology and apply it to engineering. You cannot take the subject of a sentence and apply it to another sentence. Take, for example, the sentence, this sentence here. Mathilde is artistic. And now take the sentence, the piggy, Porky, is fat enough to kill. Now, can you take the predicate artistic and apply it to this sentence here and say Porgy is artistic? Can you take this, Porgy is fat enough to kill, and apply it to Mathilde? Well, neither can you take the conclusions of one science, simply because there's evolution of the biological order doesn't follow that God is evolving, that marriage is evolving, that everything else is evolving. When, for example, you have hurt the palm of your hand, you do not call in a florist. Something, if you break the key in your door, you do not call in a piano tuner. Something happens to your windpipe, you don't call in a plumber. If you want to discover the authenticity of a Rembrandt, you don't call in the Lord Chancellor. He's a specialist in law, but he's not necessarily a specialist in art. And therefore, every particular science has its own domain, its own method. And a good thinker will not allow the methods and the categories and the theories to overflow into other domains. And furthermore, it's always a good thing to remember that if you marry the mood or the spirit of an age You will be a widow in the next one. These fashions simply do not last. And it is not to be said that if one does not follow each of these fashions, that one is behind the times. No, one is behind the scenes. And scenes, the theories that were popular years ago will be forgotten in 10 or 15 years, but we've got to have some principles that do not change to live by. Who today knows Herbert Spencer? How many books of Herbert Spencer are taken out of the public libraries of the United States? Yet everybody read Spencer 50 years ago. Nobody knows him today. That's going to be true of the same ones who create the mood of this hour. Therefore, to think well, one has to have principles that are independent of space and time, by which one can live. And we know that these principles exist, and we know there's such a thing as truth, simply because there's a logos, there's an intelligence behind the universe. And one of the great thrills of thinking is to know all the sides, but also to know what is right and what is true. Why, it's a romance very much, as Chesterton says, like driving a chariot, six wild horses, driving them down a mountain lane road. And on either side of this mountain road, there's a ravine here, precipice here, chasm here, and a pit here. And the thrill of following truth is to drive those horses straight down that line. Oh, it's the easiest thing in all the world. To be a rightist, for example, in politics, all you got to do is tumble over. The easiest thing in the world to be a leftist, just fall over. Let go. It was the easiest thing in the world to be an Arian in the 4th or 5th century. Easiest thing in the world to tumble into some mood today. Very easy to be a communist, just as simple as falling off a log. Very easy to be a Nazi. All you got to do is fall into the other side. And so the great romance of truth, therefore, consists in hewing to this straight line, knowing the pitfalls, driving the horses of truth directly, and seeing all of these errors and moods, prostrate and fallen and forgotten, but driving ahead, reeling but erect. That's the romance of thinking. That's the joy of truth.